President Obama took his case for military action in Syria to a skeptical American public last night. He said our ideals and principles, as well as our national security, are at stake. Were you convinced? This is River to River from Iowa Public Radio News. I'm Ben Kiefer. The president asserted the need to keep pressure on the regime of Bashar Assad. At the same time, he asked Congress to delay a vote on the matter while his administration pursues a diplomatic path. We'll discuss the curious course of events in this crisis and ask, what now? Also, remembering 9/11, our analysts, Bruce Gronbeck and Stefan Schmidt. Join in with your observations about the crisis in Syria right after this news. A frenzied week of developments, an uncertain path ahead for a president, his legacy on the line, a Congress with no appetite to tackle this thorny issue. It's River to River from Iowa Public Radio. I'm Ben Kiefer. Politics Day, Wednesday, has arrived. Joining us today with their observations on the crisis in Syria and how the U.S. is reacting to it. Stefan Schmidt is with us, University Professor of Political Science at Iowa State University in our Ames studio. Hi, Stefan.
Good noon, I guess.
Good just afternoon, perhaps right. We could say. Bruce Gronbeck is with us by phone, Emeritus Professor of Communication Studies at the University of Iowa, joining us from Colorado. Bruce Gronbeck, welcome to you.
And good morning before noon, thank you.
You get away with that out there in Colorado.
We do.
Let's talk about the president's speech last night, and we want to reach out to our listeners and ask you, did the president convince you that a military strike is necessary if diplomacy fails? Do you see a compelling national security threat here? Join our conversation. 1-866-780-9100. River to River at iowapublicradio.org. We're also on Facebook, and you can tweet us at IPR Talk. Well, President Obama laid out the case last night for military action in Syria, saying the proof that weapons were used by the regime of President Bashar al-Assad is irrefutable.
When dictators commit atrocities, they depend upon the world to look the other way until those horrifying pictures fade from memory. But these things happened. The facts cannot be denied. The question now is what the United States of America and the international community is prepared to do about it. Because what happened to those people, to those children, is not only a violation of international law, it's also a danger to our security. Let me explain why. If we fail to act, the Assad regime will see no reason to stop using chemical weapons. As the ban against these weapons erodes, other tyrants will have no reason to think twice about acquiring poison gas and using them. Over time, our troops would again face the prospect of chemical warfare on the battlefield, and it could be easier for terrorist organizations to obtain these weapons and to use them to attack civilians. If fighting spills beyond Syria's borders, these weapons could threaten allies like Turkey, Jordan, and Israel. And a failure to stand against the use of chemical weapons would weaken prohibitions against other weapons of mass destruction and embolden Assad's ally, Iran, which must decide whether to ignore international law by building a nuclear weapon or to take a more peaceful path. This is not a world we should accept. This is what's at stake.
And the president also made a humanitarian case for intervention last night.
America's not the world's policeman. Terrible things happen across the globe, and it is beyond our means to right every wrong. But when, with modest effort and risk, we can stop children from being gassed to death and thereby make our own children safer over the long run, I believe we should act.
President Obama last night in his address to the nation about the crisis in Syria, what do you make of it? Did he convince you of the necessity of a military strike should diplomacy fail? 1-866-780-9100, River to River at iowapublicradio.org, our email. Post a message on our Facebook or tweet us at IPR Talk. Let me turn to our guest. Stefan Schmidt, let me go to you first. What did the president need to do last night, and did he do it?
Well, no, he didn't do it. And if I can sort of step back and try to tell you how I viewed the speech, I viewed it in the context of the fact that there really is no Obama foreign policy doctrine worldwide. There is no Bush doctrine or anything like that. It is foreign policy by ad hoc decisions and often by sort of throwaway phrases that are thrown out and that then set off a chain of events, like drawing a red line on poison gas. And there is, stepping a little bit lower than a global concept, there is really no American foreign policy and strategy for Syria. And this has gone on now for more than 2 years. And to pinpoint a gas attack and make that the crux of how we're going to deal with the crisis in Syria is sort of absurd, because 100,000 died in Syria. Only 1,500 of them, as far as we can tell or so, died from a poison gas attack. And so we have no policy towards Syria. And if we had started developing one 2 years ago, we might be much further along the road to putting an end to that civil war. And so Obama's words were sort of, in a sense, empty, narrow, and I don't think that anyone came away from watching his speech or listening to it on radio or reading it, which I did this morning, saying that he has raised a compelling case for anything in particular.
Bruce Gronbach, let me turn to you. And as far as the speech itself, high points, low points, rhetorically, what did he have to do?
Well, he certainly did have to justify what not only what he is doing now, but he also tried a bit anyway, what he's done in the past. And Stephen's right, it's been a zigzag affair in trying to handle Syria. And, one general comment before I get into the speech, and I think this is in large part his reaction to the Bush years in Afghanistan and Iraq, which he saw were terrible mistakes, and he didn't want to go back to that sort of thing again. And also, when we got to deal with places like Libya and so on, we were working with NATO forces, we were working with allies, and then I think he was probably a good deal more comfortable. That sense of being out there alone, I think, has made it just almost impossible for him to articulate what Stephen is looking for, a kind of coherent foreign policy that might even reach outside the borders of Syria. But as to the speech, I found it very interesting that he did not spend time talking about policy. He did not try to make this that, but rather was using what many would consider, I suspect, soft arguments. The two clips you played illustrate all three of them. One is the regular reference to children. They're talked about four different times in the speech. I too read the speech, Stephen, and with certainly the toughest one being, to my friends on the left, I ask you to reconcile your belief in freedom and dignity for all people with those images of children writhing in pain and going still on a cold hospital floor. That he really has used the children argument and the slaughter of children as a strong, as we say in rhetoric, a pathetic or a piece of pathos that he's going to. And several times, the policeman argument, he obviously must have decided was probably the more important of the objections, or at least the one he wanted to drive home and maybe then get more support in Congress and from some people anyway, as the policeman argument. We're not the policemen of the world, and yet we've got some policing to do. Mm-hmm. This has been a kind of theme for several American presidents. We did actually do one police action, right, in the Korean War. We've done some policing in the past, and we've certainly done this in the name of peacekeeping and in the name of treaty defense. The Gulf of Tonkin Resolution was there, of course, to help all of our CETO allies. That we've been very afraid to declare war, And yet we don't want to simply be called the policeman that gives us, as he senses it, too much responsibility. So he went to that argument in hopes that that would give him a little bit of traction, I suspect, with both his congressional and his public audience. And then the first thing you quoted, the domino effect. It's very hard to show. He's obviously very hard for him to show the effect of Syrian policy on the United States' own welfare and its self-protection. So he went to a complicated kind of domino theory. If you give an inch, they'll take a foot. If you take a foot, they'll take a mile, and on and on and on.
And what this would show to Iran? What this would show to Iran and other tyrants out there, right?
Mm-hmm. Turn them all loose, and they'll finally be in our back stoop. A kind of fanciful argument. It's not that it couldn't possibly happen that way, but it showed him reaching out, trying to build a chain with one or two kind of clanky links in it that goes from acting powerfully in Syria, and then finding a way to stop it from coming to our back door. I think those three kinds of arguments, the children, the policemen, and the domino theory, showed that he is working, as Stefan said, really very pragmatically, trying to deal with a specific problem, set of problems he's got in the here and now in North Africa. And he's just really having trouble making that work.
Bruce Cronbank is with us, along with Stefan Schmidt, on this Politics Day, talking about the president's speech on Syria last night, the Syrian crisis, what the U.S. role should be there, what it should do. We want to hear from you what you thought of the president's words last night. Were they convincing to you? 1-866-780-9100. Let's go to Jenny. Jenny is in Red Oak listening. Hi, Jenny. Welcome to our program. What did you think of the president last night?
Hi, Jenny. Hi, thanks. I was completely not convinced. It's like I love the zigzag kind of metaphor. It's all over the place. I would like one of your guests to comment on the hypocrisy of why chemical weapons in Syria now and why not when chemical weapons were being used in Iran several years ago. You know, it's just so political and so I just don't buy it. And I want to just tell you, my 14-year-old said, oh, I guess it's okay to kill people in other ways, but since they're killed by chemical weapons, that's not okay. I thought that was a very astute comment from a young man, and I had to agree with him. Yep, there's some hypocrisy here that's just blatant for me.
Okay, Jenny in Red Oak, thank you very much. Let me turn to you, Stefan. The Assad regime carried out this gas attack in a Damascus suburb, over 1,000 killed. That's at the center of this latest crisis. But we estimate that over 100,000 have been killed by the bullets and bombs since the start of the war. Remind us why the international community views gas differently.
Well, it views it differently because if it is used in battlefield conditions, it sort of indiscriminately kills, and it kills large numbers of people, and it's a hideous death. I'm not sure it's worse than getting shot in the head or some other way of dying. But it doesn't discriminate between combatants and civilians, and it is used as a tool of terror to essentially demoralize the population so they won't support whoever you're trying to demoralize. And that was the purpose, I think, of this particular attack. But the real problem here is that we also have a big story right here in the New York Times today. I'm looking at it.
We hear it, Stefan.
Okay. I got a little too close to the microphone, but it's crispy and nice. I don't always read the paper version, but I like it a lot because I can underline stuff better. The rebels attacked a Christian town of Malula, and pretty much wiped out, or at least drove out all of the Christians who are horribly upset. And we know that the rebels themselves have been committing atrocities. And so the problem with Syria is you can't back the good side because this war has degenerated into maybe not symmetrical atrocities, but certainly both sides have been executing people and committing acts of war against civilians. So it's a really a bad place for the United States to jump in and try and sort out who's good and who's bad. I mean, it may in the end be that Bashar al-Assad is the most desirable of the undesirable political forces in the country, that he at least maintained stability over the years of his rule. And so that's at the backdrop of the dilemma of Obama trying to figure out how to deal with this. Now, I've talked to a couple of my friends who have some of them work in Congress and some of them work in the diplomatic service. Their view is that we finally had decided that we were going to actually try to diminish Assad's fighting capability by actually going in with cruise missiles and airstrikes and drones and diminish his overall military capacity under the guise of trying to deal with the poison gas and thereby shift the balance of power and then perhaps support the more moderate of the rebel groups with a more robust CIA and U.S. military training program in places like Turkey and Jordan, and that the Russians and President Assad pulled the rug out from under what was a larger policy by offering this particular deal of pulling, having inspectors coming and decommissioning the gas, which now makes it very difficult for Obama to proceed with the plan to essentially damage the Assad government's military capability. Mm-hmm. So there are all these, this is like a gigantic German opera, with there are all kinds of different songs and actors and players and ladies with big horns and swords. And it's not clear to me exactly sort of what the total picture looks like and what the purpose was of finally deciding to use military force against Assad. I guess maybe the inside poobahs of the National Security Agency and the Defense Department and the CIA decided that this was the best excuse for using military force against Assad. And that is now off the table. So in some regards, at least, Obama last night was in a hopeless situation because he had to try and explain why, his threat of military force was necessary and then why it had led perhaps to something that would not necessitate military force. And it just leaves us really sort of just in rudderless. I mean, going, I don't know in what direction in our policy towards Syria.
Let's hear another one of those players, as you said, the voices in this opera, I think you mentioned. Republican Senator John McCain, of course, having a lot of opinions on this. He's been a strong proponent of not only a military action in Syria, but also military action that would result in regime change. On NPR this morning, he said he's very skeptical of a deal to get Syria to relinquish its chemical weapons that's brokered by Russia.
Are we going to have the fox guard the hen house here when they're the ones that are providing these weapons massively, by the way? Plane loads of weapons fly in every day into Damascus from Russia as well as... my skepticism is very high. You can't rely on the Russians to be doing the work to police weapons that they are supplying.
Okay, John McCain this morning on NPR's Morning Edition. Stefan, how skeptical should we be about Russians' intentions here?
Totally skeptical. The Russian endgame, of course, is partly their geopolitical interest in the region, but the Assad government owes the Russians a huge amount of money for weapons shipments and other supplies. If the Assad government falls, which might have been the case if the U.S. had launched airstrikes against his military forces, it might have tipped the balance. And Assad leaves the country, the Russians are stuck with the bill, basically. They're stuck with hundreds of millions of dollars, perhaps $1 billion worth of military equipment that they've sold to Assad and hasn't been paid for. So they have a very double interest in not having the United States come in on essentially indirectly on the side of the rebels with airstrikes. Mm-hmm. And they have a great interest in negotiating this deal. And I actually disagree sort of with McCain. I think that this is the best deal they could get, because if the U.S. gets involved militarily, the balance would certainly shift. If they can broker the decommissioning of chemical weapons, it leaves Assad in an actually pretty good position, because his primary assets are non-chemical military weapon systems. So it's a good deal for the Russians, and I think they actually will try and push Assad and follow through and get a UN resolution. They'll vote for it, because this is for them a pretty terrific outcome.
Bruce Grunbrecht, your thoughts on Russia's intentions in this?
Well, I think a couple may be operating. Certainly their own prestige as a broker, I think would help Putin overcome at least some of the negatives that fly around about him. Secondly, on as you look at the southern border of Russia, if chemical weapons start circulating at all, they're not that far from Iran, and in a whole series of unstable stand countries that also might possibly get involved, and Syria's not that far away, and on. So they've got potentially a southern border problem that could be helped by the control of chemical weapons. And the third thing is Russia steps in, I agree that the United States, for another reason, breathes a sigh of relief, because now if that mission fails, it's not the United States who's failed, it's Russia who's failed to control the bad boy down there.
But it could be seen as Russia playing the U.S. and the international community. Yeah.
Could. At least
that's the question right now. Yeah.
It would certainly be that way in this part of the world. In other parts of the world, maybe not. I think it's a fascinating question. And I think Putin is probably motivated pretty strongly to pull this off, to see if he can pull this off. For help of his own country and for the sake of their prestige.
Bruce, let's go to George in Chertin before the break. We've got a break coming up very quickly. George, what's your question or comment?
Yeah, well, this whole so-called civil war started with people protesting, but the fact of the matter is it escalated when Saudi Arabia introduced arms and money into Syria from bases in Jordan and Turkey with the help of our CIA. And this was reported in both the New York Times and the Wall Street Journal. It's been going on over a year now. So really, we've already had a role in this civil war, and we have bloody hands. There are people who have been dying over there because of our cooperation with Saudi Arabia for regime change, and that you know that the cruise missiles are intended for regime change, just like they were in Libya. So this whole debate, this is just a sham. What Obama is talking about is a complete sham.
George from Sherdan, thank you very much for your opinion. We're looking for you today to weigh in, sound off on the situation in Syria, on the president's speech about it last night, the need for a military strike if diplomacy fails. 1-866-780-9100. What do you make of the president's handling of this case? 1-866-780-9100. River to River at iowapublicradio.org. Our guests today, Stefan Schmidt, University Professor of Political Science at Iowa State University. Bruce Grunbrecht, Emeritus Professor of Communication Studies at the University of Iowa. Hope you'll join us. Stick around for the second half hour as we continue with Politics Wednesday here on River to River.
Support comes from Quality Care, the nature care company, working with our natural environment for a beautiful, healthy lawn and landscape, and proudly supporting Iowa Public Radio since 2003. Since 1980, quality work done with care.
Back with more of River to River from Iowa Public Radio News, I'm Ben Kiefer. It's Politics Wednesday. Bruce Grunbrecht with us of the University of Iowa. Stefan Schmidt of Iowa State University, looking at the situation in Syria, what should be done there. Also reacting to the president's speech last night. If you heard it, we'd like to hear from you. Are you an Obama backer? Are you backing him in this case? Did you hear something in the speech last night that you liked? Give us your reaction, 1-866-780-9100. And we have some reaction here, Stefan and Bruce, just to go through a few of the initial ones. Stephanie writing to us, "I love how Americans are always ready for war when there is something material to gain, but not willing to go to war to help civilians. Americans are always ready for war, except when they have nothing to gain." Nina writes on our Facebook page, "I don't need confirmation that sarin gas was used. It doesn't matter, especially when over 100,000 innocent civilians have been slaughtered by the Assad regime and over 6.5 million refugees have been displaced from their homes." And Colin writes on our Facebook page, "Can one of your guests comment on the irony of a Nobel Peace Prize-winning president trying to persuade a reluctant public to go to war? Obama's thought process through all this is utterly baffling to me," writes Colin. Stefan, comment on that, please.
Yeah, well, sometimes you have to break some eggs to make an omelet, and sometimes you have to use military force to combat a greater evil. I mean, you know, that's been the history, whether you think it was correctly done or not, or necessary, of, you know, World War One and World War Two. And so, you know, it's unfortunate. And I think that what is really unfortunate is that we have a tremendous military capability, but we have a weakened and underfunded diplomatic corps, diplomatic service. Americans are a bunch of ignoramuses, frankly, and that's the only word that fits, because a huge majority of Americans think that, you know, as much as a third of the federal budget is foreign aid, when in fact it's 1%. And when I teach my class where we do federal government budget, you can not even see the slice on the pie of how little the U.S. uses foreign aid, which is often a pretty good leverage tool to bring about change. It probably works a lot better than dropping bombs on people. So, you know, I understand that, you know, the United States is in a precarious situation trying to hold together the Middle East. You don't want it unraveling and falling apart. On the other hand, we stepped back and supported the Arab Spring, which was to bring democracy and freedom to many of those countries, including, of course, Libya, Egypt, hopefully Syria as well. And the Arab Spring, as you know, turned out really to be essentially a nightmare because, bad as they were, the dictators sort of were the glue that kept things together. And we had no real policy, as far as I can tell. The Obama administration certainly didn't, how to replace those dictators with some other unifying glue or agent that would prevent those countries from just simply falling apart, as happened with Benghazi. You know, which I guess today is the anniversary of the attack on the American embassy or the American consulate in Benghazi. And we, you know, we helped overthrow Gaddafi by providing, you know, military support and some air power, and then had very little, if anything. We didn't even have enough to protect our own diplomats in that country, and we had no fallback policy. And you can't do that. And so I think the Obama administration, unfortunately, is going to go down in history as an administration with a highly failed foreign policy. On the one hand, all he did was to complete the W. Bush policies in Iraq and Afghanistan, mm-hmm. and not much novelty. And so then you get, you know, Steve King and, you know, Dennis Rodman becoming primary negotiators, going around and talking to foreign governments, because our own government, you know, doesn't have the full robust thrust in the foreign policy area. And I think it's a sad picture.
Certainly a lot of criticism out there for the president on this issue. This quote from Politico: "Barack Obama's unsteady handling of the Syria crisis has been an avert your gaze moment in the history of the modern presidency, highlighting his unsettled views and unattractive options in a way that has caused his enemies to cackle and supporters to cringe." Now, the president has been losing, it seems, rather than gaining support for military action in Syria. Congressman Michael Grimm, he's a Republican from New York, and he's also a combat veteran, initially said he would vote in support of action. saying U.S. credibility with nations like Iran and North Korea was at stake. Well, late last week, though, he withdrew that support, saying it was too late.
I think that the world is looking at us, including Iran, including North Korea, all of our allies as well as our foes are looking at us and saying the president of the United States has lost his resolve. He's indecisive. And I don't think that we can get that back. You know, once you lose your credibility after a certain point, you can't get it back. And at this, at the juncture we're at now, by the time the Congress actually votes on this, I don't think we can get our credibility back even if we strike.
Okay, that's Congressman Michael Grimm. Obviously, not an Obama supporter, Republican from New York. But before we go back to the phones, Bruce, so when we talk about this speech last night, was there anything the president could have said rhetorically that could have changed the equation, or was the timing wrong, too?
Well, I don't think he could have said anything. If he had simply narrowed a purpose down, to talk about the Putin initiative or something like that, and to say why at this point, even though we have our military at full readiness, we're going to make this move. Maybe if he'd narrowed down and dealt only with that, but he chose to repeat a lot of ground he's been covering, especially over the last week and a half, in other talks that have been going on in the news, so that there was very little that was new, except for answering the maybe more fully the policeman argument, and as I said, making sure that we saw the dead babies. It was so thinly spread, I think, for a short speech that it couldn't accomplish. It could not possibly accomplish all those different his two goals that he initially set. Why does it matter, and where do we go from here? He couldn't have handled that in a 15-minute speech.
Bruce and Stefan, let's go back to our phones. Chris in LeClaire. Hi, Chris.
Hello.
Go ahead, Chris. You're on the air. What did you think of the president's speech last night and how he's been handling the Syrian crisis?
Well, I've really been happy with the fact that he put the decision to Congress initially. I think that's because, for me, that highlights the illegality of what's been done in the past. I mean, in the past, leaders have bombed countries and invaded countries because they knew that once the boots were on the ground, debate would be over, and they could do whatever they wanted to do. And so, for me, this was the way it should happen.
Okay, Chris, thank you for that comment. Let's go to Tom in Des Moines. Hi, Tom.
Yes, good afternoon. I just wanted to make the comment that Obama is speaking to an isolationist nation right now. We're in one of our historical isolationist modes where we're hard to rouse towards making an impact on the rest of the world. And one of the big difficulties that he is facing in terms of motivating us to respond to the chemical attacks is that he has helped put us in this isolationist mode by saying we should stay out of Syria. All up until this time, he said Assad must go, but he hasn't done anything to back it up with, and he's just keeps saying, well, we can't get involved in wars, and that, of course, reflects the American people's sentiments. But he's been reinforcing the American people's isolationism as it is right now, and all of a sudden he wants to change that. So it's incredibly difficult for him right now. Even though he gave a fairly decent speech last night, it's incredibly difficult for him to change people's minds and change their orientation overnight.
Okay, Tom in Des Moines, I think that's a great point. Stefan Schmidt, we have President Obama elected in 2008 by attacking the hawkishness of George W. Bush, don't we?
Well, we do, but, you know, on the other hand, what's ironic is that if that's the case, I mean, Americans are exhausted from 11 years of war and tremendous expense, huge human suffering, lots of American suffering, casualties and suicides, among veterans and military, the coin of the country expended with a massive national debt. And so to have a president who isn't, you know, he isn't going to use the hammer of the military because every foreign policy issue looks like a nail is probably consistent with, as the caller said, the fact that Americans are just exhausted and they haven't seen good results. I mean, what have been the positive results in Iraq? It's a mess. Afghanistan is unraveling, and I don't think much is going to come of that at great cost. And so maybe Obama will go down in history as a president who was extraordinarily cautious and not decisive, and that was more or less what the American public wanted, not more international adventures. You know, that's another way to look at it.
David is with us from Ottumwa. Hi, David. Welcome to the program.
Hi. Hi, how you doing?
We're doing well. What's on your mind? Yeah, go ahead.
Well, I've been an Obama backer from the very beginning and everything, okay? And I believe what he did was right when he pushed his vote to Congress, okay? But I believe eventually Russia and Syria are going to procrastinate, and then we'll have no other choice but to take strategic action. I listen to my comments on the radio.
Okay, David, thank you for that from Ottumwa. So not a positive, not an optimistic view about Russia's actions in here. Let's talk a little bit, get your reaction to the political side of this. Here's a quote from the Washington Post. Syria has utterly confounded the Washington political establishment, from the White House to the Capitol. There's no script for what's been happening. The usual political polarization, the simple calculus of Republican versus Democrat, has disintegrated into a tangle of uncomfortable alliances. Also reflected here in Iowa's congressional delegation, members of Iowa's congressional delegation making it clear they would all be no votes if it were taken this week on a military strike in Syria. So, Stefan, tell me, you know, politicians like to say they are above party politics when we have situations like this, when it comes to national security issues. How much do you see party politics playing a part in the Syrian crisis?
Well, I mean, oddly enough, Democrats and Republicans in the public are pretty much in agreement over this issue that they're opposed to using military force. Democrats and Republicans in Congress are pretty much in agreement, even though Obama was going to come to them, that they were going to vote no. And that includes the entire Iowa delegation, which generally splits on issues because we have, you know, Republican senator and a Democrat and two Republican and two Democratic House members. They all seem to be saying, you know, we're not going to give them the authority to launch because we don't know where that's going and what the ultimate outcome of that is. So,
And they're listening to their constituents.
And they're listening to their constituents, and there is a convergence of the constituents and the members of Congress, which sometimes doesn't happen. And, you know, beyond that, I should add that, you know, there's some very interesting journalism today on what it would take if, in fact, the Russians and the Syrians are serious about decommissioning the chemical weapons. And it's a nightmare. I mean, this is going to go on for a year or two, because if you read the New York Times today on the front page, it's Amy Smithson, who's an expert on chemical weapons, says it's a gargantuan task. The inspectors have to mothball production, install padlocks, inventory bulk agents and munitions, and then a lot of it has to be destroyed. And you have to have protocols going in on what parts of the Assad military establishment would qualify for inspection, because there are all kinds of bombs that are used that could be essentially weaponized with chemical weapons but are not necessarily that. So do those have to be decommissioned? This isn't going to be something that happens over the next weekend. This is going to drag out, I think, for at least a year, and therefore it changes nothing.
Let's go to what I think will be our last caller, Jake in Muscatine. Hi, Jake. What's your view?
Hi. I just wanted to comment that I think Obama is being motivated by the intelligence community to strike in Syria, because we would have the opportunity to put CIA agents on the ground and get a lot of information about the rebel army, which is undoubtedly going to have people from other countries in the Middle East in it. And I think we could gain a lot of useful intelligence information from being involved in this war.
Jake, thank you very much for that comment from Muscatine. Stefan, it's safe to assume that CIA has long been in Syria in some fashion.
Yeah, and bombing something doesn't give you intelligence. It just destroys property and breaks glass. So, you know, we do have a lot of intelligence there. We are training Syrian rebels, as I said, in Jordan and in Turkey. And we're going to continue doing that. And as a previous caller said, we have been, in fact, sort of sticking our finger in there in very unobtrusively. And I think, yes, the intelligence community 2 years ago began to say we need to get in more quickly and with greater assets to try and sort out who is who and try to prop up the, you know, the moderates and try to repel and discourage the extremists. And I think that's probably still the objective. And it's whether we bomb or not, that is what we're going to do. And it's going to just go in that direction, I think, where we are going to, in fact, support the rebels somewhat more and maybe partition the country and set up a separate area of Syria that Assad can be the president of. If he's willing to sort of do that.
Let's spend the last few minutes at least getting some reflection on this anniversary, the 12th anniversary of the attacks on 9/11, also the first anniversary of the attack on 9/11 in the U.S. consulate in Benghazi a year ago. Bruce, can I start out with you on your thoughts? I don't know how it's being remembered out there in Colorado, but, you know, anniversary after anniversary happens. We remember this grave occurrence, the largest domestic attack in U.S. history.
Yeah, out in Colorado, there are a couple, three places that are building new war memorials, especially for in the name of soldiers who were killed, and in other cases, civilians who were killed, first responders. So that part of the movement goes on. I mean, what strikes me, especially since we have been facing a series of almost wars in over the last few years, is how much 9/11 has become what for the colonists was the Boston Massacre of 1770. It became the Boston Massacre where five people were killed on the spot and a couple more later, a mob, that it became an occasion for an annual speech pushing hard on the need for Americans to form themselves into a country and to remember the sacrifice of the martyrs and to commit themselves to the series of vows that would make them, by the time we get to 1775, a strong country. And the Boston Massacre speech really went on for quite a while, and periodically it went on to even well into the 19th century. I think we use 9/11 in that way as well, in hopes of reminding ourselves again who we are, what we have been through, what we have survived, at least on the positive side, what we are committed to. There's also the negative side of reminding ourselves that some of us at least think that all Arabs and Muslims are terrorists and profiling and all that other kind of thing that goes on at the same time. But it becomes that kind of occasion. It becomes a significant date like the 4th of July that will stand to mark a particular joint in American history, I think. And okay. I think in that sense it is really even bigger than we usually even think of it for us.
Stefan Schmidt, can I give you a minute for your reflections on 9/11?
Yeah, I think that's true of our generation, of Bruce and myself and some others. I have a class with 200 students. Most of them are freshmen. This was 12 years ago. They were little kids. They kind of remember sort of September 11, and when we talk about things, they mention it. But I think as with the Patriots and the British, the memory slowly begins to fade, and yet we've set up an apparatus that is premised on September 11, and that's the National Security Agency, the surveillance of American intelligence of Americans and others, which is a permanent structure that has been put in place. That's the biggest legacy of September 11. Mm-hmm. Our privacy has been completely compromised as a result, and we are a completely different nation. The First Amendment is undermined, and We are going to be much more of not a police state so much as the, having the capacity to become a state that is not as free and not what the founders would like.
Stephen Schmidt, University Professor of Political Science at Iowa State University, thank you for joining us.
Thank you.
And Bruce Gronbeck, Emeritus Professor of Communication Studies at the University of Iowa, thank you for joining us.
Good to be back.
Okay, good to have you back. And River to River is produced by Sarah Bowden, Ben Stanton, and Emily Woodbury. Technical support from Dennis Reese in Ames today. Help from Jason Burns, the executive producer of Iowa Public Radio's talk shows, Catherine Perkins. Joining me now in the studio to talk about Talk of Iowa tomorrow, Charity Nebbe is with us.
Hello, Ben Kiefer.
Hi, Charity. What's in store for us tomorrow at 10?
Tomorrow on the show, we're going to talk about grandmothers. We're going to talk about how the roles that grandmothers fill in their grandchildren's lives have changed over the past few generations. And then we're also just going to talk about grandmas in the 21st century. How do you connect with your grandkids? How do you communicate with your grandkids? How do you maintain a bond when sometimes they are so very far away?
I can imagine there will be a lot of input from our listeners for tomorrow. All the different types of relationships that exist between grandmothers, grandkids.
Right.
And oh, sounds like a wonderful show. Thank you, Charity, for coming in and
Thank
telling
you,
us
Ben.
About it. Charity Nebbe, host of Talk of Iowa. Tune in tomorrow at 10 o'clock for that. River to River is a production of Iowa Public Radio News. I'm Ben Kiefer. Thanks for joining us. Thank you.